Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine. My name is Jason Consul. This is week 4 of the February 2024 Model Railroader magazine. This week we'll be reading from the following articles: Step by Step, How to Animate an N-Scale Excavator, and Benchwork and Track for Fremont. Step by Step, Paint, Decal, and Weather Boxcars. Contributing editor Lou Sassy painted, decaled, and weathered these two On-30 boxcars for his Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes layout, the maintenance of way cars add visual interest to his rolling stock fleet. Photos by the author. While watching model railroad videos on YouTube, I happened upon one that provided me with an interesting project. The modeler had painted and heavily weathered some Bachmann 18-foot boxcars on his On-30 railroad. They were unlettered and decrepit-looking, just the thing you might see on one of the main 2-foot railroads in the 1930s. Inspired by the video, I ordered a pair of Bachmann On-30 boxcars from an online auction website. The models were painted boxcar red and had a minimal amount of lettering, providing a perfect starting point for my project. Instead of following the video project, I painted, decaled, and weathered the boxcars to look like aging maintenance-of-way equipment, or MOW, for my On-30 Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes. To save money, full-size railroads often reassigned older freight and passenger cars to MOW service. Boxcars are used as tool, material, and storage cars. Tank cars can be found transporting water, fuel oil, or chemicals. And covered hoppers are used to store dried sand for locomotives. In earlier eras, stock cars made handy, albeit labor-intensive, tie haulers. Heavyweight, and some lightweight, passenger cars were used as bunk, kitchen, material, outfit, storage, and tool cars. The passenger cars were modified with updated windows, safety appliances, and new or extra roof vents. Depending on the situation, MOW cars might move in a solid train or be handled a few at a time as part of a freight train near the end of the train. Though I used On-30 models for my project, you could adapt these techniques for other scales. A weekend project like this is a great way to develop a variety of modeling skills. Step 1. Removing lettering. Though the lettering was minimal, I wanted to remove it so it wouldn't be visible under the new paint. I started by applying a generous coat of micro-scale micro-sole to the lettering on the doors. After letting the decal setting solution sit for about 5 minutes, I scrubbed it with a stiff bristled brush, in picture 1. I then wiped the same area with a cotton swab dipped in mineral spirits to remove the rest of the printing, picture 2. The micro-sol and mineral spirits had no effect on the builder's stencil to the left of the door and the capacity data to the right. I used a cotton swab dipped in lacquer thinner to remove this lettering. See picture 3. Do this in a well-ventilated area, preferably a spray booth, and wear appropriate personal protective equipment. I worked quickly and used a light touch so the thinner wouldn't damage the paint or melt the plastic. As soon as the lettering dissolved, I wiped the surface dry with a piece of flannel cloth. Step 2. Priming and painting. Next, I removed the doors and disassembled both boxcars. Then I washed the models in warm, soapy water to remove any impurities that would affect paint adhesion. After rinsing both cars, I let them air dry. I'm a fan of the worn wood effect Bachmann uses on its On-30 boxcar floors, so I masked that area with blue painter's tape. To avoid handling the cars during the painting process, I placed 2 wood skewers in a cardboard box spaced to match the truck bolsters. Then I spray-painted both bodies with Rust-Oleum Light Gray Automotive Primer 208-1830, see image 1. I used the same techniques for painting the underbody, see picture 2. I spray painted the doors on a piece of sheet glass, see picture 3. I painted the doors' backs first. Once the paint was dry to the touch, I flipped the doors over and painted the front. While waiting for the primer to dry, I shifted gears and worked on the wheel sets. Using a pair of sprung tweezers as a handle, I spray painted the wheel sets Valspar Flat Labrador Brown, 85046, see picture 4. I later cleaned the wheel treads with lacquer thinner and a cotton swab, see picture 5. I carefully scraped paint off the axle ends with a number 11 blade. Another option is to mask the treads with tape and the axle ends with liquid mask prior to painting. I let the primer on the boxcars dry for 24 hours. Then I applied Tester's Gloss Coat to the car bodies in preparation for decaling, see picture 6. Step 3. Sweating the details. The Bachmann boxcars have many factory-applied parts, but they lack uncoupling levers. I fashioned mine from 24-gauge wire and two Taurus products, small eye bolts per lever, as shown on the car on the right in picture 1. I painted the uncoupling levers with the now-discontinued model Master Rail Brown, then touched them up after installation. The lever should be placed between the car end and brake rod on the B end. Next, I replaced the plastic Bachmann Easy Make couplers with metal KD number 28 offset shank couplers. The KD couplers compensate for the low ride height. Since I don't use magnetic uncoupling ramps, I clipped off the trip pins and painted the couplers model Master Railroad Tie Brown, see picture 2. I also added high-tech details O-scale rubber air hoses, HTD-7501, to the boxcars. I used small cardboard jigs to keep the hoses at a 60-degree angle. Then I applied a 5-minute epoxy to the hoses for a stronger bond, see picture 3. Step 4, time for decals. I let the tester's gloss coat dry thoroughly. Then I lettered and numbered the cars with micro-scale railroad Roman white, alphabet set 90001. I started by cutting the letters and numbers as close to the graphics as possible, eliminating unnecessary clear decal film. Then I soaked them in tap water until they slid freely from the backing paper. While the decals were soaking, I used a brush to apply micro-scale micro-set to the area where the decals would be applied, see picture 1. The setting solution improves adhesion and softens the decals. Next, I applied the letter and number decals. Satisfied with their position, I blotted off the excess water and micro-set with a cotton swab. Later, I used a paintbrush to apply micro-sol to the decals, see picture 2. The solution softens the decals, helping them conform to irregular surfaces like the wood grain detail and the seams between the boards. After the microsol evaporated, I used a number 11 blade to pop any trapped air bubbles, see picture 3. Then I applied another coat of setting solution. Patience is key here. You may need to repeat this process several times. Once I'd removed all of the air bubbles, I applied Tester's Dull Coat. This sealed the decals and gave the boxcars a uniform, flat finish. Step 5. Adding weight. I like the rolling stock on my layout to weigh around 5 ounces. The two On30 MOW boxcars were less than 4 ounces each. However, there was plenty of room inside the boxcars to add weight. I purchased steel adhesive wheel weights at a local auto parts store. Before installing the weights, I attached them to a piece of lightweight cardboard, see figure 1, and painted them Model Master Engine black. The weights I used were lead-free. However, other wheel weights can contain lead. If you use those, wear nitrile gloves while handling the weights and wash your hands thoroughly after they've been installed. Then, using a wood skewer, I placed a large glob of weld bond on each car's floor. I pushed the weights into position, out of sight. See picture 2. After the weights were installed, I loaded the car with boxes, barrels, and other items from my scrap box. See picture 3. I left the boxcar doors partially open so the items would be visible. Since the Bachmann truck side frame assemblies are plastic, they're very light. I placed a round steel washer, painted black, to the underside of each side frame with epoxy, see picture 4. The hole in the center of the washer makes it easy to reach the truck mounting screw. The washer increases the unsprung weight of the cars and helps them track better. Step 6, multi-step weathering. I finished up the MOW box cars by weathering them. First, I applied an India ink wash, 2 teaspoons of ink to 1 pint of 70% isopropyl alcohol, to the underbody of both cars and let it dry. See picture 1. Next, I mixed Model Master Engine Black and tap water on a paintbrush to create a wash that I applied to the car sides and ends. Once the application was dry to the touch, I dipped a soft cotton cloth into a 91% isopropyl alcohol and wiped off the excess, see picture 2. I used cotton swabs to get into the areas I couldn't reach with the cloth. I applied a heavier wash to the roof, darker near the running boards, and lighter along the edges, see picture 3. For the truck side frames, I scraped black and rust-toned pigment sticks into powders with a grater. I placed a small bit of the pigments, along with a few drops of 91% isopropyl alcohol, in an artist palette. After wetting a semi-stiff bristle brush with the alcohol and removing a bit on a soft towel, I dipped the brush into the pigments. Then I brushed the various colors onto the side frames, see picture 4. I also added rust to the door tracks, stirrup steps, corner brackets, and grab irons. I applied the mix of isopropyl alcohol and rust-toned pigments with a small brush, see figure 5. Finally, I used the dry powders and a soft bristle brush to add streaks of rust to the car sides, see picture 6, and grime to the car ends. That concludes the step-by-step section. How to animate an N-scale excavator. Bring a static construction scene to life using RC servos, by Stephen Sunshine. Photos by the author. Stephen Sunshine used remote control servos to operate this N-scale Tommy Tech excavator. His techniques can be used to animate models in other scales. As a child, I would watch my Lionel train run around an oval of track on a ping pong table for hours. While the trains were neat, the most interesting item on that layout was the cattle loader, where cows vibrated in and out of stock cars. I now model an N scale, but I want my railroad to have the animation I enjoyed in my younger days. After searching for a suitable item to animate, I came across a Tommy Tech excavator. The construction vehicle is now the focal point of a building site on my model railroad. The Tommy Tech excavator is articulated at 4 points, as shown in picture 1, opposite on the page. Point 1, the turning joint, allows the excavator to rotate 360 degrees. The second is where the boom meets the body. The third point is where the boom and arm connect. The final joint is where the bucket meets the arm. To control the movements electrically, I connected each of these articulation points to a servo housed in a wood bracket mounted under the layout. Servos are used for motion control in remote control, or RC models, such as cars and planes, and in robotics. I used servos instead of regular electric motors because a servo can be moved precisely to a specific position. A motor's motion has to be limited by some sort of cutoff switch. Since this was the first time I used servos, I had to learn what they were and how they worked. A great online resource for hobby servo fundamentals is princeton.edu/tilde-mae412/NTRAK2002/292-302.pdf. Excavator disassembly section. To begin, I disassembled the excavator by removing 2 screws in picture 2. Then I carefully removed the pins securing the boom and bucket by tapping each with a small nail and hammer until they moved enough to be pulled out with needle-nose pliers. I slightly enlarged the holes using a reamer and filed both sides of the holes so the parts would move freely, see picture 3. I then reattached the boom and bucket, but left off the cab and treads. Next, I built a wood bracket that extends under the table about 7 inches, see figure 4. The bracket, made from quarter-inch top dimension and half-inch back and ends dimensions, plywood, holds the 4 servos. The actual dimensions aren't critical, though the top should be big enough to hold the excavator and slightly larger than the hole cut in the tabletop for mounting. The bottom has to be small enough to fit through the tabletop hole and large enough to hold the servo that controls the rotation of the crane. Then I put the excavator near one side of the top of the bracket, placing it close enough to the edge so the excavator can pick up dirt from the site when the boom is fully extended. Once I determined the excavator's position on the top of the bracket, I drilled a half-inch hole in the plywood. I then glued an 8-inch length of quarter-inch styrene tube to the underside of the excavator at its pivot point. See picture 5 on page 31. I bent a 2-inch piece of 22-gauge solid hookup wire around the tube in the shape shown in figure 6. This serves as a support for the styrene tube in the opening. I attached a circular horn to the GWS S03N standard servo for articulation point 1. I then glued a 3/4-inch length of 1/4-inch plastic tube to the center of the horn with cyanoacrylate adhesive, or CA. I then inserted a 2-inch section of 3/16-inch brass tubing into the plastic tube and glued it in place with CA. The brass tube allows for precise placement of the excavator above the bracket later on. I temporarily secured the servo on the bottom of the bracket with double-sided tape, as seen in picture 7. Later, I trimmed the 8-inch piece of 1/4-inch plastic tube so the excavator sat 1/2-inch above the bracket. I temporarily connected the servo to the controller to make sure the excavator moved freely. After the test, I secured the servo to the plywood base with a servo bracket. Making the connections section. I attached the 22-gauge solid hookup wire support to the top of the wood bracket with CA, making sure the plastic tube was centered in the opening. Doing this limited the rotation of articulation point 1, the pivot point of the excavator, to 180 degrees. For articulation point 2, I drilled a small hole in the boom to hold a bent piece of 15/1000-inch piano wire. This wire passes through the bracket on the side of the excavator that's hidden from view and into a small diameter styrene guide tube. I attached the wire to a single horn on a Power HD sub-micro servo and tested the installation. Then I glued the servo and guide tube to the 1/4-inch styrene tube with CA in picture 8. To make the arm, articulation point 3, flex and extend, I drilled two holes in the boom and inserted small eye bolts made of 22-gauge solid hookup wire. Next, I drilled a 1/16-inch hole in the base of the boom and the 1/4-inch plastic tube. I also drilled a small hole at the top of the arm. I routed 26-gauge stainless steel wire from underneath the wood bracket through a small guide tube, the 1/16-inch hole, and the small eye bolts on the boom to the hole at the top of the arm, see figure 9, opposite. Once the top of the wire was in place, I connected the opposite end to a single horn on a second Power HD submicro servo. Once again, I tested the installation before gluing the servo and the guide tube to the 1/4-inch tube. I shifted gears and worked on the bucket, articulation point 4. I bent two loops into the ends of a 1/2-inch long piece of 22-gauge solid hookup wire. Then I glued the wire to the side of the bucket away from the aisle. I drilled two holes in the arm for 22-gauge eye bolts. I tied 4-pound test monofilament line to each loop and routed it through the eye bolts and the same 1/16-inch hole I used for the boom wire. Once the monofilament line was through the bracket, I tied the ends to holes on the opposite sides of a crosshorn on a third Power HD submicro servo. After confirming the bucket worked, I put a drop of CA on each knot I made in the monofilament line. I also attached the servo to the 1/4-inch tube, see picture 9. At this point, I connected the servos to a 4-servo controller and ran a final motion test. Final assembly section. To reattach the cab and treads to the base, I separated the two treads from the plastic piece holding them together by cutting carefully with a razor saw and gluing them to the bottom of the base. Next, I reattached the cab to the underframe and positioned the excavator slightly above the surface of the wood bracket. Once in position, I glued the quarter-inch plastic tube to the brass tube attached to the servo. Since I needed to operate four different servos, I used a servo motor driver kit from Carl's Electronics, CK1403. The kit's contents are shown in picture 10. The only items not included are the power supply, potentiometers, and knobs. After soldering the components to the printed circuit board, picture 11, I extended the wires from the kit to the potentiometers using 9-wire cable. I placed the potentiometers in a small project box that I purchased at Radio Shack, though any project box will suffice. I made a color-coded diagram of the excavator and attached it to the front of the project box. Then I drilled four holes for the potentiometers and used color-coded knobs to match the diagram in picture 12. Now I can move dirt from the excavation site to a nearby dump truck. If you're looking to add animation to your model railroad, try servos. They're easy to find and use and will bring an otherwise static scene to life. Stephen Sunshine lives in Putnam Valley, New York, where he models an N-scale. This is his first byline in Model Railroader magazine. Benchwork and track for Fremont. Part 2. Fremo module specifications dictated a lot of decisions on our HO scale project layout. With the track on Fremont Mills module laid and wired, editor Eric White, pictured left, and senior editor Cody Grivno are pleased to run the first locomotive on the HO scale layout. By Stephen Ott, photos by the Trains.com video staff. As I mentioned in the first installment of the series on our HO scale Fremont Mills project, this is the first time the Model Railroaders staff's annual layout was built as a Fremo module. Modular standards like Fremo, free-mo.org, let modelers build small, self-contained sections of model railroad that can be connected and operate with those built by others who follow the same standard. Modular standards work by specifying the size, shape, track placement, electrical wiring, and other features of the model to guarantee interoperability. The selling point of Fremo is that, unlike many other modular standards, between the rigidly defined endplates, modelers are free to build almost anything they like. So we were surprised to discover just how much the Fremo standard does define. It's true that within the bounds of the endplates, curves, reversing sections, and even elevation changes are allowed. But the standard also specifies the track code, minimum turnout size, minimum curve radius, turnout wiring, control system, electrical connections, accessory power, even aesthetic features like ballast color and what color paint to use when weathering track. A lot of layout building decisions that we tend to take for granted were taken out of our hands by these specifications. Rest assured that we still found plenty of room for creativity within those boundaries in the form of the structures and scenery. But those will be the subjects of future installments in this series. First, our project layout needed a sturdy base, bulletproof track work, and reliable wiring. Read on to find out how we accomplished this. When we built the benchwork for the Fremont Mills module, we flipped the script, literally. Rather than start with the legs or other supports, then the framework, then the tabletop, we took a top-down approach. I transferred the track plan outline, full size, to the plywood tabletop, starting with a 1-foot grid. We cut out the tabletop, flipped it over, and attached the framework to the bottom. Then we attached the all-important end plates, and finally the legs. This approach let us adapt our benchwork plan as we built and guaranteed the top would come out exactly the size and shape we wanted it to be. We used conventional half-inch plywood for the top. Since the track locations at the end plates are the most important for modular interconnectivity, I transferred those to the plywood first. Next, I printed out full-size paper templates of the turnouts and punched holes in them so I could mark the frog and switch rod locations. Finally, I drew in the flex track connections between the turnouts. Since in my plan I had nothing nearly as sharp as the Fremo minimum radius of 42 inches, I freehanded them rather than measuring with a trammel or template. For the open grid framework under the tabletop, editor Eric White ripped 3/4-inch furniture-grade birch plywood into 4-inch strips. Joists made this way are less prone to warping and shrinkage than even high-grade dimensional lumber. We placed the side beams first, using wood glue and countersunk screws. Next, after making sure their placement wouldn't interfere with the locations of any under-table switch motors we might want to add later, we measured, cut, and added the cross pieces, see picture 1. The only tricky part was the angle where the module bends. We put an extra brace across the inside of this joint to keep it rigid. Next, we installed the end plates, the size and position of which were dictated by the Freemo standard, see picture 2. Eric cut these from 3/4-inch birch plywood. The legs were a bit of a departure from our usual building methods, too. We usually prefer to build legs from L-girders and add casters to facilitate moving the layout, since our projects often shuttle back and forth from the workshop to the photo studio to the hallway outside. But the Freemo standard calls for adjustable feet attached with T-nuts, so we built trestle-style legs from 48-inch long 2x2 lumber, reinforced with 1x3 crossbars and 1x2 angle braces, see picture 3. Because of our angle fascia, one leg doesn't have a brace, see figure 4. Once these were bolted in place, we adjusted the feet to bring our track to the required 50-inch elevation. Our layout was now ready for track. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine. My name is Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com. In collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at aftersight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.